All right, we are in 2 Kings chapter 14 today. I have to cover some minor prophets, and I will be not covering, but starting Jonah today as well. Not actually reaching the book necessarily, but talking about who the man was, because he pops up in our storyline of the kings in this chapter. We get to start learning about what he said and what he wanted and what he did. We're in 2 Kings chapter 14. We'll go through a prayer first. Almighty God, our Father in heaven, thank you for your kindness and loving hand. And please help us, Father, to listen to your voice, to speak your words to our children and grandchildren and those whom we love. That's your way we know. We trust you. Open our eyes and our ears that we understand your voice. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen. We are in 2 Kings chapter 14. In the second year of Joash, son of Joahaz, king of Israel, Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, became king. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned for 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jehoadan of Jerusalem. He did what was proper in the eyes of the Lord, but not like his forefather David. He did everything his father Joash had done. However, the high places did not cease. The people continued to sacrifice and burn incense at the high places. It happened when the kingship was firmly in his power that he struck down his servants who had assassinated the king, his father. But he did not put to death the sons of the assassins. As is written in the book of the Torah of Moses, which the Lord had commanded, saying, fathers shall not be put to death because of sons, and sons should not be put to death because of the fathers. Rather, a man should be put to death for his own sin. He struck Edom at the Valley of Salt, 10,000 men, and captured the rock in battle. He called the rock's name Yochteel, which is its name today. Thereupon Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, let us confront each other in battle. Now Joash, king of Israel, sent word back to Amaziah, king of Judah, saying, the thorn bush in Lebanon once sent word to the cedar of Lebanon, saying, give your daughter to my son for a wife. The wild beast of Lebanon then came by and trampled the thorn bush. You have routed Edom, so your heart became arrogant. Maintain your honor and stay at your home. Why should you provoke evil against yourself and be defeated, you and Judah with you? But Amaziah did not listen. So Jehoash, king of Israel, went up, and they confronted one another. He and Amaziah, king of Judah, in Beth Shemesh, which is in Judah. Judah was defeated before Israel, and they fled, each man to his home. Jehoash, the king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Joash, son of Ahaziah, in Beth Shemesh. Then he came to Jerusalem. He made a breach in the wall of Jerusalem from the Ephraim gate all the way to the corner gate, a distance of 400 cubits. He took all the gold and silver and all the articles were found in the temple of the Lord and the treasuries of the king's palace, along with the hostage children, and he returned to Samaria. The rest of the deeds of Joash and all he did in his might and how he went to war against Amaziah, king of Judah, behold, they are recorded in the book of Chronicles, the kings of Israel. Joash lay with his forefathers and was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. His son, Jeroboam, reigned in his place. Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, lived for 15 years after the death of Joash, son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel. The rest of the deeds of Amaziah, behold, they are recorded in the book of Chronicles, the kings of Judah. They organized a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem. So he fled to Lachish, but they sent after him to Lachish and killed him there. They carried him with horses, and he was buried in Jerusalem with his forefathers, the city of David. All the people of Judah then took Azariah, who was 16 years old, and crowned him in place of his father Amaziah. He built up Eilat after having restored it to Judah after King lay with his forefathers. In the 15th year, the reign of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria and reigned for 41 years. He did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and he did not turn away from all the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, that he caused Israel to sin. He restored the boundary of Israel from the approach of Hamath to the Sea of Araba, like the word of the Lord, God of Israel, which he had spoken by the hand of his servant Jonah, son of Amittai, the prophet, who was from Gath-Hepher. The Lord had seen that Israel's suffering was very severe, with neither hidden property nor public property. There was no helper for Israel. The Lord did not say to erase the name of Israel from under the heavens, so he saved them through the hand of Jeroboam, son of Joash. The rest of the deeds of Jeroboam and all that he did, and his might that he performed in battle, how he restored Damascus and Hamath to Judah with Israel. Behold, they are recorded in the book of Chronicles, the kings of Israel. Jeroboam then lay with his forefathers and the kings of Israel, and his son Zechariah reigned in his place. Now, 2 Kings chapter 14. Before I go into my little spiel about this chapter and about Jonah and what he's doing in this chapter and what he's experiencing in his life, are there any questions regarding this chapter, what I've read to you? Relatively self-explanatory, just a matter of events, right? Well, it is a matter of events, but there's specific events that God has in mind of what he's mapping out here. The no question goes just straight to my little, I'll try to make it little, discussion of today. First of all, the discussion is going to take us a few other places in your Bible. It will take us to 2 Chronicles as well as possibly getting to the book of Jonah. We'll see. This event, when Amaziah becomes king, he becomes king while Elisha is still alive. Now, Elisha, of course, was recorded, his death is recorded in chapter 13. His death records roughly during the latter half of Josiah's reign as king. So Amaziah becomes king, and he's a king for 29 years. He's still alive. So Elisha's still alive when this happens, when he becomes king. We don't know if he's still alive when the two kings battle or not. So it's not recorded the exact timing. But I want to bring something out to you. Amaziah was king of Judah, right? And Joash, king of Israel. Now, we're going to read something about Joash and why these two kings are actually fighting. This is not a provocation by Amaziah, though 2 Kings records this one. And actually, the war was provoked by Joash, by something his men were doing. They killed 3,000 of Judah's citizens while Amaziah was at war with Edom. They sent raiding parties in and killed them. So Joash actually provoked the battle between both men, though the words being written back and forth, and Amaziah losing the battle and being captured and his family being captured, is all part of the plan. Joash is actually the one who's worse off, meaning as far as his actions. So all this stuff is happening and going with these two men, but I want to bring something out to you, and your attention at least. To Amaziah, now I know these names are confusing because he used the same names for different men, use the same names. So Amaziah's father was Joash. He actually spelled the same way. He was the king of Judah. Not to be confused with this Joash, who was the king of Israel. So two different men, two different descendants. If you remember correctly from it all, this Joash was a little boy when he became king. He was 7 years old, roughly. And he did okay early on. Meaning when he was early on. The reason he did okay, because he was trained by the high priest, he was raised by the high priest. High priest at the time was teaching him very, very closely, holding, keeping tight reins on him, so to speak, as he was growing. But the high priest eventually got old, at 130 years old, died. Well, this particular king, though he was raised knowing what the high priest taught him, he had a character flaw, a significant one. He didn't obey the word of God, didn't obey the Torah of God, because he loved God. He did it because he was told to. There's a difference. Different guy. That's a third one on. That's a third one later on. They reuse their names a lot. Forgive me. There's a third guy that shows up and does the same thing. Named Joash. Yeah. Right. It did sound like it. No, a different. Another one in. I think it's chapter either 18 or 19. Another one pops up in the scene, and he's the one who finds the book of the Torah and they say, "Oh wait, there's actually a real God, and this is what he wants." So this, he was told to follow God. The reason we say he's told to follow God is because the moment the high priest died, men came to this man and said, "Hey, we've been dealing with this, you know, your new rules since you've become king. And we're following them according to what you said, but we want to go back and do the things we're accustomed to doing with the high places and everything else we need to sacrifice." And he said, okay, go for it. And then bad things started to happen to him. And to Judah in particular. Now, a number of prophets went to Joash and told him, "Hey, bad things are happening because you're allowing Judah to return into the ways of Israel. And they're not supposed to do so." Joash killed those men who said so. One of them was the son of the high priest. He grew up with him. Pretty awful. It's almost like your brother, essentially. Because your brother said, "You're doing something wrong. I'm going to kill you now." So he has this issue of killing prophets. That was previously. Now we're going to talk about Amaziah, his son, who has the same issue. Like father, like son, I guess, so to speak. Go to 2 Chronicles, chapter 25. Now we're not going to read all of chapter 25. It's a little bit lengthy. But just certain highlights of it. We're starting out in we'll talk about that one in a minute. We're going to jump back. We're two different spots in chapter 25. We'll start out later on in it. We'll go back earlier in a minute. It says 2 Chronicles chapter 25. 2 Chronicles 25, starting out in verse 14. Now Amaziah, by the way, has just defeated Edom. They went down towards Lamath and he's way down south. Now, Edom has been free from Judah for 60 years. Now, they were subdued by David 220 years before. In the last 60 years, they've had freedom until Amaziah says, "Enough's enough, I'm not going to go crush you." Now it was, verse 14. It was so, after Amaziah came from the slaughter of the Edomites, that he brought the gods of the people of Seir and set them up to be his gods, bowed down before them and burned incense to them. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was aroused against Amaziah, and he sent him a prophet who said to him, "Why have you sought the gods of the people which could not rescue their own people from your hand?" So it was, as he talked with him, the king said to him, "Have we made you the king's counsel? Cease. Why should you be killed?" Then the prophet ceased and said, "I know that God has determined to destroy you, because you have done this, and have not heeded my counsel." Amaziah has a crooked way of doing things. So Joash actually killed prophets. Amaziah is threatening to kill a prophet if he doesn't keep his mouth shut. Their following of God was not within inside them, but rather an instructional, you know, okay, this is what we do. So there was no heart, so to speak, behind both men. That's the type of character you're dealing with. In Now we're going to jump back a little bit to explain why Amaziah and Joash of Israel had a war. And it wasn't necessarily because of Amaziah's screw-up or his arrogance. Go back in 2 Chronicles chapter 25. We're back up all the way to verse 5. Now Amaziah gathered Judah together and set over them captains of thousands and hundreds according to their fathers' houses throughout all of Judah and Benjamin. He numbered them from 20 years old above and found them to be 300,000 men of war who could handle a spear and a shield. He also hired 100,000 mighty men of valor from Israel for 100 talents of silver. But a man of God came to him, saying, O king, do not let the army of Israel go with you, for the Lord is not with Israel, not with any of the children of Ephraim. But if you go, be gone, and be strong in battle, God shall make you fall before the enemy. For God has power to help and to overthrow. Amaziah said to the man of God, What shall I do about the 100 talents which I have given to the troops of Israel? The man of God said, The Lord's able to give you much more than this. So Amaziah discharged the troops that had come to him from Ephraim to go back home. Therefore their anger was greatly aroused against Judah, and they returned home in great anger. Then Amaziah strengthened himself, leading his people who went to the Valley of Salt, killed 10,000 people of Seir, and the children of Israel took captive another 10,000 people alive. They brought them to the top of the rock and cast them down on the top of the rock, so they all were dashed into pieces. As the soldiers, the army which Amaziah discharged, so that they would not go with him in battle, they raided the cities of Judah from Samaria to Beth Horon. They killed 3,000 in them and took much spoil or plunder. Get a picture of who these guys were? So Amaziah, his soldiers killed 10,000. They captured 10,000 and then pushed those 10,000 off a cliff. That's pretty brutal. Now, it's interesting because Ahab came up to a similar scenario, not the cliff thing. But he had a group of men that was brought into his capture by Elisha. He said, Shall I kill the men? And Elisha at the time had told him, Wait a minute, you wouldn't kill men in battle that you captured. Why would you kill these men? So Ahab, of course, lets him go. Amaziah now is brought up to that situation. He actually captures 10,000. And they aren't just men. They push him off a cliff. Awful individuals. So Amaziah is pretty wicked. But Jehoash isn't any better. Now, Jehoash, however, has one thing on his side. A prophecy that's given to him from Elisha, which we had read last chapter in chapter 13 of 2 Kings. We're not going to go back there again yet. But because this is happening, now, you notice the prophet had told him in, seven of 2 Chronicles 25. It said, Do not let the army of Israel go with you, for the Lord is not with Israel, not with any of the children of Ephraim. So as far as the prophet's concerned for Amaziah, God has abandoned Israel. That's the prophet's telling him. He's not with them. That's prophecy in and of itself, because Israel will be wiped out about a generation and a half from this time. They get captured away. But he's pointing out to him, he's not with him. Now, Amaziah listened to that prophet, but whether it's the same prophet or not, when he comes back from Edom, he threatens to kill the prophet who speaks to him poorly at that time. Both prophets threatened to point out that God's going to kill them, but Amaziah listened to one, and disregarded the other. A little wishy-washy, similar to his father. So much difference in as far as the two men are concerned, although Amaziah, in some respects, a little bit worse, but it's marginal. Amaziah, however, ends with the exact same fate, so to speak, use that term. In verse 25, as it records down, Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, lived 15 years of the death of Joash, son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel. The Messiah, Amaziah, from first to last, record the book of Kings of Judah and Israel. After the time that Amaziah turned away from following the Lord, they made a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem. He fled to Lachish, but they sent after him to Lachish and killed him there. So Amaziah and Joash, his father, both have the same fate. They're both executed by their servants, or at least by people who serve him. So they're dead. But what happened to this guy? Now, one of the things we read about, we'll get to Jonah in a minute. When he takes out Amaziah and captures him, and then he follows to Jerusalem and knocks out 400 cubits long wall of Jerusalem, enters in, plunders the city, what does he plunder specifically in 2 Kings, as it records? The golden serpent from where? God's house. Now, God doesn't usually take kindly to that. Just in general, in case you haven't noticed that the Bible is a theme. If you take something from his house, usually you or someone who did it with you dies shortly thereafter. Joash's fate is the same as all the others. The same year this happens, he's dead. So he doesn't make it very long after he takes Jerusalem. Because he takes Jerusalem in Amaziah's 14th year of reign. Yes. That's when he takes Jerusalem. Amaziah only reigns 29 years. That's 15 years left over. It says Amaziah is king for 15 years after this guy's death. Do the math. He dies the same year he does this. So, Jehoash, God did not take kindly to him conquering and taking out God's temple. For a lot of reasons, that's his short end, so to speak. So after this event, he dies. Because the agreement from Elisha, right, it's falling down here. The agreement from Elisha in chapter 13 was given to Joash, king of Israel, that he would strike Syria 3 times. Remember that? 3 times, the whole arrows, hit the arrows to the ground, the 3 times, struck Syria 3 times. And that was the deal that was given to him. But that's not exactly what happened, per se. It happened, he did strike 3 times. But it wasn't him. It was his son, Jeroboam. Because that's recorded in verse 28. The message of Jeroboam, all he did is mighty perform battle, how he restored Damascus, which is way over here in Syria's territory, in case you know where Syria isn't, if you don't know where Syria is today, it's Damascus is still their capital. Restored Damascus and him off to Judah. He was actually a gift. So Jeroboam, I just misspelled his name, his army comes from here, takes Damascus and Hamath, which is a little bit further south and east, and gifts them to Judah. Yeah, exactly. Not a normal thing to happen. But there's a reason why. The last time I was up here, I told you that there was political things going on at the time when Joash talked to when Elisha talked to Joash, and of course Joash's son, soon to follow, that made the conquering of these Syrians 3 times a little bit easier. Do you recall anything of what I said? For example, who's on the other side of Syria? Another country called Assyria. They wipe out just about everything. They don't take out Judah, but they take out pretty much everything from north of Jerusalem onward. They take it all. So Assyria is on the other side of the country of Syria. To get them not confused, you could call Syria Aram, because that's who they are. But it's a screwing. That'd be confusing too. So Jeroboam, he's coming out of here. He takes out Damascus, Hamath, he actually takes out a larger chunk over northern section, which he keeps, of course. That's his own territory. He takes out large portions of Syria relatively easy in comparison. Obviously, God helped him. But he takes it relatively easy because at the same time, Syria is dealing with other superpowers on their other side. Because the other side of Syria is also another country. Is that not the Y? Which does I spell it? B-A-B-Y. Thank you. Babylon. Thank you. Babylon is also on the other side of Syria. They have the fortunate of wonderfulness of having bordering both countries. Not much different than today. Both these two countries don't like each other. They still don't. They still don't like each other. So they're on the other side. Now they are superpowers or growing superpowers. They're fighting amongst each other. Syria at this moment in time Assyria does, has a conundrum. They have a problem. By the way, their capital city is Nineveh, which today we call it Mosul. Let me erase this. At this moment when Jeroboam is fighting Syria and Jerusalem is helping and they're dealing with these issues and Jeroboam is restoring greatness and having all this wonderful stuff happening, Assyria has had, let's see if that's the right word, a bad reputation. A self-imposed bad reputation. So Assyria's been around for a couple hundred years at this point in time. They are known for two things. Their cruelty and their power. Cruelty, their fame, was unparalleled in their area. Unparalleled. They held the top cruelty power, fame, or title, as you say, for over 200 years. And this is toward the end of their first 200 years. They are a top cruel power. Now, they also are power hungry. They like to capture, and they've been fighting Babylon, and they've taken territories back and forth for years. Assyria is known for this cruelty, and so when opportunity arrives, they take it. Because their cruelty, Jeroboam's king of northern Israel, but God doesn't like cruel people, does he? So God made a decision, a choice, during Syria's power, or this time, actually the moment which Jeroboam is conquering, or actually just before Jeroboam actually takes the three strikes against Syria, God makes a prophecy and declares something about Assyria. A prophecy regarding their capital city. Nineveh, I think I spelled it right. Forgive me if I spelled it wrong.
Nineveh.
He makes a prophecy about Nineveh. What was a prophecy? You probably already know it by heart. Ever heard of a man called Jonah? Right. Now this Jonah is the same one recorded here in verse 25. Now Jonah has been around in northern Israel. He lived through the tail end of, all of Jeroboam's father's reign. So, Jonah is alive during Jehoash. So Jonah most likely knows or knew or probably hung out with Elisha. They're the same parallel, know each other. There's something about Jonah, though. If you recall the first part of his story, he doesn't want to deal with God's direction to deal with Nineveh. Why? Those are awful. They are awful. He knows they have a cruel reputation. No. Israel's not Nineveh. This is the Assyria. Yes, the Assyrian people are Nineveh. They're one and the same. Nineveh is their capital city. He knows they have a cruel reputation, and so much so, he also knows Nineveh has gone through two plagues already. Plague, P-L-A-G-U-E? I was going to be still with plaque. Forgive me. Some plague. You're going to screw it up. Two plagues. They were back to back, actually about 20 years apart from each other. And it already struck Nineveh. They struck Nineveh right about time when Jonah and Joash were younger men. They struck the first time, 20 years later, roughly, this plague strikes again. So Nineveh's already in the process of suffering punishment. There's severe punishment. The plagues were killed off thousands of citizens of Nineveh. Both of them did. Only 20 years apart, so basically it's two consecutive generations get hit hard by plagues. So thousands of people have died of Nineveh. And they're on a direction of destruction, of self-destruction. Assyria has also been going through a series of very weak kings. They've been battling Babylon for many years, and Babylon's gaining power over them slowly. Here's the problem. If Assyria loses and gets wiped out, then what's going to happen to Israel? God has a plan, remember? We know who takes Israel, right? Assyria does. Does God want Assyria to get destroyed? Well, they've been 200 years of horrible, cruel reputation. He doesn't like cruelty. But he doesn't want them destroyed yet. He has a plan for Assyria. And that's to conquer northern Israel.
They haven't done that yet.
So God is not going to after or want Nineveh to be destroyed yet. Though he says if they don't get warned, they're going to be. Nineveh is a very large metropolis area, of course. I don't recall the exact size. People have been rumored on its size and its scope of the big of a city. It's like it's a metropolis. It's multiple towns shoved into one. So this is the purpose as to what Jonah is not pleased about. He knows Nineveh's gone through two back-to-back plagues. The first one may have been actually before Jonah was born. Not quite positive on the exact date. The second one is while Jonah is definitely alive. Probably doesn't want to catch it, whatever it is. Doesn't want to go there. He knows they're cruel. He would love nothing more to have them wiped out. The problem is if they were wiped out, what happens to Israel? They continue on. There's always Babylon. Babylon will have taken Assyria and be quite happy for a long time. And God has a timeline. His timeline doesn't deviate. So all this stuff's happening politically, as well as militarily, at the same time these men are fighting. We get to talk about Jonah a little bit. We're just gonna touch on him. I didn't want to spend a lot of time on Jonah today, because there's a lot in it.
Aha.
Right, he's going to use them. Yeah, he's going to wipe out the northern tribes. We've discussed this method of God a number of times. Syria is pretty bad. Assyria is worse. Both countries, are they any worse than northern Israel? They really aren't. Well, not quite. They're even a little bit... They are very similar, you're absolutely right. However, Syria and Israel have been enemies for years and years and years. Nothing new there. They go back and forth on territories, and they try to underhand each other and stab each other in the back, so to speak. Assyria is a new player on the field. Very cruel, very harsh group of individuals. But they're all both pretty awful. At least Israel, for all its horrible weaknesses, and its child sacrifice. So by the way, you know, Syria did child sacrifice, Assyria did child sacrifice, Babylon, all of this child sacrifice, nothing new there. That's all the same, it's all equal on that side. But Israel was supposed to know who God was. Northern tribe, but they were supposed to know a God, a different God than what the rest of them followed. There's a pattern of God's choices. These are no particular order. There was Judah, Israel. I'm only dealing with these four. Syria, Assyria, actually five, and Babylon. These are the basic five countries we're going to talk about just the next few minutes. Of these five countries, some of them are pretty bad. First of all, Judah is still following God. Sort of.
But they're still sacrificing, right?
Sometimes. Not all of them do. Amaziah doesn't. I believe his grandson does. Ahaz. Which actually he read earlier today. Ahaz does. Judah follows, for the most part, follows God. Now, they have their high places, they have their low places, they have their sideways places, and things they do crazy things in. That's still there. Israel does not follow God, but knows of him, and God spends the effort and time to send prophets to them. Note that. They have abandoned God, but God actually still sends prophets. Remember, there's Elijah. Elijah was sent. Elisha was sent. Jonah. It was actually Hosea. Yeah. Z-E-A. Amos. Obadiah Tekoa was also sent to him as well. He sends prophets to Israel. He also sends some to Judah, but they're the bigger names. There's, one of the bigger names. There's a Jeremiah and Isaiah are sent to Judah. Ezekiel too, actually, all three of them. Were all sent to Judah. They were the southern tribes. But the northern tribes, they had the minor prophets. Elijah are not minor per se, but they didn't write anything down. These men were still sent, so God's working with Israel. And on top of that, he even sent Elisha to Syria. though Syria has no care whatsoever about God. God even sends Jonah to Assyria. All these countries, now the Babylon, he didn't actually send a prophet per se. One could argue Jeremiah was an advocate for Babylon for many years and helped them out through the process. So you could say he sent it, but they sent themselves to Jeremiah, not the other way around. All these are awful people. But if I had to worse rank them, Babylon, though isn't yet, they're probably the worst. Not yet. So Babylon isn't yet, but they're probably the worst. They are conquering, the process of conquering Assyria. They're trying to work that. When they finally succeed, they're really, really bad. Now, they weren't bad forever beforehand, but they eventually get there. Assyria, I'd probably say with number two. So Assyria, and then, you know, the third worst would have to be Assyria, and then there's Israel, number four, and Judah, number five. But who does God use, and who does he correct? Assyria, and Assyria followed. Briefly, they followed. Assyria is pretty awful. So God used a very cruel country, corrected them. They still remained cruel, by the way. They didn't all of a sudden become perfect. They're still very cruel. But they waited a whole king later to become cruel again. So it bought them a few years. He used Assyria, and Assyria comes in and takes over Syria. One that's not quite as bad. Now, Syria has already conquered many times Israel, who wasn't even as bad. And in this chapter, Israel comes over and whacks Judah for a while. Eventually, Assyria gets whacked by Babylon. And Babylon, of course, takes over everybody. Yeah. Notice a pattern? God uses somebody who is worse, corrects somebody who's not quite as worse. The worst one to work the way up. Why? Answer the question. Why? Testing? Is it testing? Is that the purpose? Well, think. I'm asking you. If that's a guess. Straighten people out. Their sins are complete. Let's go back to 2 Kings chapter 14. In verse 6. This is Amaziah. He's dealing with the death of his father, the assassins. He did not put to death the sons of the assassins. It's written in the book of Torah of Moses, which the Lord commanded, saying, fathers should not put to death because they're sons, and sons not put to death because they're fathers. For the man should put to death for his own sin. That's why. They were following God, not Torah. Judah knows what is sin. And they know what's responsibility or what the responsibility falls on, who is responsible for it. They know that. They have the Torah. They've been taught it for many, many years. Whether or not they believe it in their heart or not makes a difference. They still know what's true. They need correction. Now, you could send someone better than them to correct them. And God did. He called them prophets. Right. You don't listen to the person who's better than you. I'll send you someone who's worse. Of course, eventually they get wiped out and Babylon takes them all. And the person who's worse does a physical correction as opposed to a verbal.
So it's kind of like a verbal warning first.
It is a verbal warning first. And then you've been warned enough times. How many times have you talked to your child and say, hey, don't do that. Hey, don't do that. Okay, smack. You're not listening to me. You've done enough times, I've instructed you over and over time verbally, and now it's time for a correction, a physical correction. God's no different, he's a father. So he does this first, kind way first, warn you with words, but after he comes on with militarily speaking. And to be militarily, to conquer someone, typically you have to be stronger than them. And you're not necessarily going to be kinder. So in God's usefulness with Assyria, he needs Assyria to survive long enough to take care of northern Israel and conquer them. So Assyria is going to come over and wipe them out. Hence, Jonah is sent to save them. We're going to talk about Jonah. Now, I won't really talk about it much today. Other than there's something I want to point out to you. Because there is a second reason why Jonah does not want to go to Nineveh. It's not just their cruelty, actually, or their power type of things. His merciful and kindness, right? But there's something hidden. Actually, you're hidden. Actually, it's in plain sight. Well, it's not really hidden. It's in 2 Kings 14 that explains something about Jonah. We're back in 2 Kings chapter 14. We'll jump to Jonah in a minute. This is a tale in the chapter, starting in, verse 25. He restored the boundary of Israel from the approach of Moth to the Sea of Arabah, like the word of the Lord had said, God of Israel, which he spoken by the hand of the servant of Jonah the prophet, who was from Gath-Hepher. The Lord had seen Israel's suffering was very severe. Stop there for a second. This is verse 25 and 26. The Lord had seen Israel's suffering was very severe. The term very severe, I want to hone on that just temporarily. Very severe, that's the halfway through 26. Suffering. That is one way of translating those Hebrew words. The second way of saying the exact same words. They would translate it as very rebellious. Very rebellious. Both words, both phrases are legitimately put in there. Israel was very rebellious. With neither hidden nor public property, there was no helper for them. Or Israel's suffering was very severe. With neither hidden nor public property, there was no helper for them. Both are legitimate. The reason they're both legitimate is because God wants them to be legitimate. It's a play on phrase word. That your very severe suffering is the same as, you are very rebellious. Get that? There's a reason why they play on words. If you're suffering severely, you're very rebellious. That's what it's talking about. That's the point of the story here, of what it's saying. But Jonah had come along and did a prophecy for them. It said he had restored, we're talking northern Israel, by the way, in Jeroboam, had restored, restored from the approach of Hamath to the Sea of Arabah, like the word the Lord had spoken. Then he continues on in verse 28, the rest of Jeroboam, how he restored Damascus and Hamath Judah, the recorded book of Kings Chronicles. Israel, at this moment in time, is very suffering very severely and very rebellious, and God delivers them out with Jeroboam. But something's happening because Jonah said so. Told Jeroboam, this is what's going to happen. Great things will be restored. Same thing Elisha had just told Jeroboam's dad in for chapter 13. To strike Syria 3 times, you'll be doing a very great blow with them. All this very rebelliousness is happening, and Jeroboam was sent by God to fix it through Elisha's command and his prophecy. Israel has experienced something. One could argue it's an economic revival. This is before they conquered. They're experiencing economic revival. They're going through a conquering phase and they're expansionary. They're doing great. They're loving life. They're very blessed right now. Now, point out here, however, their suffering was very great or the rebelliousness was very great. Neither hidden nor public property. There was no helper. That's what was going on just before when Jonah then prophesied, this is what will happen. You will then become great. But Jonah doesn't get to see it. He has to go to Nineveh. He doesn't get to stick around and watch his, quote, message come true. He has to leave. He doesn't like that, and don't get me wrong, another prophet had the same problem. Ever hear of Jeremiah? He didn't like it much. He said, hey, God, you sent me to tell me all these bad things about Judah. I'm telling him, I'm telling him, telling him. But nothing's happening. And I'm being made fun of. Jeremiah wants to see whatever he's saying come true. And okay, is it really going to happen, God? Come on, do something about this. Quit making me a fool. Exonerate me. Jonah is human being too. He made prophecies that all this great stuff would happen. And God says, okay, great, now go to Nineveh. What? I don't get to see any of this. I don't get to experience any of it. I have to go to a plague-ridden, evil, cruel country to save them? Yeah, I don't think so. And so he runs. So there's more than one reason why Jonah doesn't want to go. He actually wants and likes that Israel will finally, after all these years of suffering, have freedom for a little while. Though he knows it's only for a little while, because once Assyria is saved, it's all over. Probably, because Amos, his friend, talks about it. So they're all in the same group together. The person who does get to stay in Israel and watch this revival is Amos. So Amos stays back while Jonah goes on to Nineveh. Now, I don't know how much information from Jonah makes it back to Israel about his successful trip in a fish belly. Internet, yeah, exactly. The community text message. What was that? Hosea is probably a very young boy, or well, actually probably a teenager, at the time which Jonah's leaving. So Hosea gets to experience it too, but it's toward the tail end. Amos is about the same age as Jonah. Roughly, not exactly. Amos starts prophesying when he's like in his 30s, which about the time which Jonah takes off. A little before that, actually. So Amos is a farmer. He's actually gets to experience some of this growth process and he's talk about what God's going to do. Because all this wonderful expansionary policy that's happening in northern Israel, Amos is telling them all, including Jeroboam, it's going to come to an end. And it's not good for you. No, he said, you're just going to die. He tells me you're just going to die. That's what Amos winds up telling Jeroboam, you and your whole family and your line and everything else. I don't recall actually. He may have actually said those words a few number of times. He tells all of Israel to repent a few times. I don't know if he actually talks specifically to the king himself. The message is sent to the king via a high priest, and it's a little bit convoluted, you know, playing the telephone game, so to speak. I won't say what they do or don't think. It is possible that they think the prophets are not quite all there mentally. I can't say one or the other. So that's what's actually happening in 2 Kings 14. Now, as I pointed out, Amaziah dies or has died at the end of this chapter. That's when Ahaziah, or Uzziah, as you might know him in 2 Chronicles, becomes king at 16 and reigns for 52 years. He is a good king. He makes some foolish mistakes, but he's a good king. One of the longest reigning kings. We're going to talk about him. When he comes on the scene, the king of Judah, known as Uzziah, we're going to jump a little bit into Isaiah as well, because Isaiah is alive at that time. So Isaiah, though, was a little bit young at this point with Jeroboam and Jonah's taking off. I don't know if he's actually born yet. He might have been born at the time. When Jonah leaves to Nineveh, Isaiah may have been born. I'm not quite positive on his exact age. About the time he comes over to southern Judah and starts talking to those kings. Because these kings are following, Judah is following the steps of the kings of Israel. They're doing it a couple hundred years later. Roughly. So all this stuff is happening politically as well as spiritually within inside these guys' lives. It has been. But it explains the background as of what the prophets are living through. See, if you just go through and read Jonah. Okay, well, he starts out, you guys lazy? Come on. Having no knowledge as to why or what he's thinking or living through. If you just read Amos by itself, having no knowledge what the kings were doing, he's just an ornery guy that's angry at everybody. And Hosea, okay, you got your own problems. You have family issues. So, if you just read them in their own the books, you only get the surface topics. You have to know what the kings are doing and what these men have experienced through. What Elisha went through trying to teach these men what they should be doing versus what they are doing. That's what we want to go to within context. So now you understand a little bit what Jonah has seen or experienced early on. Next time we can talk about him. About what he actually does. Yes, Ellie.
Also, don't know who people are today that play out the same
situation.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week probably as well. There's a reason I said that Nineveh was the capital of Assyria. It is modern-day Mosul. You've heard of Mosul probably a number of times in the newspapers about the ISIS people and everything else they've been doing over there. Yeah, that's modern-day Nineveh. All right? Yeah, that is the same physical city, same physical land, the same territory. Guess where Jonah is buried? Was buried. Mosul. Because Jonah was buried in Nineveh, by the way. He lives and dies there. Jonah, who went to Nineveh, he lives there and he dies there. Yeah, he was not instructed to ever go home. God told him to go there. God never said go home. He stays there. He stays there and he dies there. And there's a reason why. We'll talk about that a little bit later. He stays in Nineveh. Jonah does. Once he goes, he stays there. He dies there. They bury him there. It is a permanent testimony that he's there. And against what Assyria did. His existence, his body, his grave, whatever you argue it, it's a type of like a symbol thing that says, hey, this meant something to us, the people, the territory. Well, since then, you know, Jonah's grave has been long since smashed by sledgehammers. As of at least, what, back in the summertime, I think it was? Yeah, in the summer. They crushed it with sledgehammers. Yes. So, Jonah's grave is no more. Well, they didn't like him because, one, he followed a different god. He was a prophet of a different god. And the people held him in great respect. And they didn't like that. So he's gone now. I mean, his cemetery is gone. That means things. Obviously, physically means that, yeah, there's concrete on the ground or whatever rock they used. But it means things also symbolically, because to me, my personal opinion, strictly my opinion, that when you do something like, for example, destroying Abraham's tomb, it means something. It shows a great disrespect for the individual who that represents. Now, I realize there's no person actually there anymore. It's just rock and there's dirt, nothing else in there. But what it was showed respect to, that honored, okay, there is something true that this person did in their lives and respect what they did. Right, shows respect to God. So when now the modern day, I use the term loosely, quote unquote Nineveh, also as Mosul, destroys the message of Jonah, so to speak, they are rejecting Jonah's advance as opposed to accepting it. See, the original Nineveh accepts his instruction. They responded properly. But the modern days, so to speak, of only symbolically, of course, rejected it by the destruction of Jonah's tomb. So that's my personal opinion, though. You may disagree with that wholeheartedly, and that's fine. But that's how I see it, because that's the modern day symbolism. I look at symbols all the time. If history repeats itself, ISIS is on the chopping block, so to speak. But so was Northern Israel. Northern Israel was also on the same chopping block. So it doesn't necessarily work out great. Just because one gets a chopping block doesn't mean the other one doesn't go too. See, Northern Israel was on the chopping block then. Because they refused to respond. So now it depends on the issue of Northern Israel today. If you argue that they're, I'm not sure who's who, blah, 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 has a genealogy and symbolism, who throws their hat in. But it's not quite so simple or clean cut. Other than we can see, at least in modern day, Nineveh has crushed Jonah's message, so to speak. Any questions? Any comments? Hopefully it'll be useful to you. We'll cover Jonah next time. And I will try to have a little play put up too, because I like those, and they're fun for kids.